Good evening. Please be seated. I beg your and Professor Berger's indulgence. I'm going to take about 10 minutes on my way to introducing her. I'm delighted to welcome all of you this evening, students, faculty, staff, friends, community members, and especially our freshmen and any members of their families that are here. I welcome you to this opening lecture of the Dean's Lecture and Concert Series, or what is called the formal lecture in the college's statement of the program, understood there to be part of the academic program and a necessary, if occasional, complement to the practices of our classroom. Though not always adhered to, it is our strong tradition at the college that the dean offer the opening lecture of the academic year. In this year of celebration of our traditions, I am making one of the rare departures from this tradition. I do so for some reasons pertaining to the lecture I will give instead on homecoming weekend, but for our purposes this evening, I do so primarily because the topic proposed by our visiting lecturer seemed to be so apt for the beginning of the academic year, for our sophomores who are reading Genesis, of course, but also for all of us. I remind you all that after the lecture, we have a question period. We have always called it a question period and not a Q&A, not a question and answer period, in order to keep the question primary, which means to keep the inquiry open and alive, as we try to do in all of our educational life at the college, and to indicate that although our lecturer will be the principal interlocutor in that conversation, she is not the authority. As we say of our classroom, reason is the only authority. I hope many of you will attend this question period and others in the future. As an alumnus of the college, I recall that as a student, some of the most important things I heard emerged from exchanges in question periods with our lecturers and among our tutors. The tutors appeared there free or freer from the reserve and caution and self-effacing style characteristic of them, or some of them, in the classroom. And it seems this way to me still. I hope you will benefit from such occasions, from the question periods of lectures, whether you attend many or few, and whether or not you think you have anything you are likely to ask or say. The question period will be in the junior common room directly behind me, beginning about 10 minutes after the lecture ends. President Peters spoke yesterday of the extraordinary character of 2014. For us at St. John's, a wonderful anniversary year, but a year marked also as the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I, the 75th of the beginning of World War II, and the 25th of the fall of the Berlin Wall that symbolizes, as well as anything can, the end or the beginning of the end of the Cold War. We shall celebrate our anniversary in various ways throughout the coming year. Some occasions will involve tales of our history and reminiscence. Such a retrospective gaze will be sentimental and sweet for some of us. However, for our primary purposes, we look back only in order to better understand what we are about now, today, and tomorrow, and beyond. While it may sound strange to outside observers of St. John's, it should not sound strange to anyone who has attended our classes to say what was said of us by a historian of the college, that we, quote, have no interest in studying the past as past. Or in a longer formulation by a former dean of the college, I now quote at length, our point of view that to know ourselves, we need to know our tradition, is different from historicism, the notion that we are the products of impersonal historical forces, the blindly determinist effects of a dead past. We want nothing to do with what is dead and bygone. When we speak of our tradition, we mean individual works by thinking authors that have, to be sure, shaped contemporary life in ways of which we are largely unconscious. But we can bring these works back to life and ourselves to consciousness by reading them not as historical documents, but as living presences that made us who we are and taught us to talk as we do. We are convinced that these great books contain a living wisdom necessary for thinking out our current lives, end quote. Just as we study the things we study for the sake of what can actually be thought and known by us today or tomorrow, so I hope that our anniversary celebration may serve to remind us that all that is good in the history and traditions of the college only has meaning, only lives, insofar as we take it up today and tomorrow to pursue the finest and the best education that is available to us. This evening, in town, the wonderful and dramatic celebration of Zizobra is occurring. Old man gloom will be burned, purging the sorrows of the past year on the eve of the celebration of the annual Fiestas de Santa Fe. In our own way, we too may look to the beginning of our academic year as a renewed purgation of our sorrows. Last night in your seminars with the Iliad, Genesis, Don Quixote, and War and Peace for the undergraduates, and the Mino for the new Graduate Institute students, and tonight with Genesis in a different way, we aspire to a great, if not the greatest, pleasure and consolation of life, to approach the greatest works of the greatest minds, to become active and awake in one's own thinking, to actualize one's faculties, and to contemplate, and to know, insofar as is possible, what is simply, and what is best, and what is highest. These are the aims of a true liberal education. They represent the constant, if tranquil and disciplined, joy and celebration of our community, and the deeper meaning of our anniversary celebration. As this part of inaugurating our year, I am pleased now to introduce our lecturer this evening, Rana Berger. Professor Berger earned her doctorate in philosophy from the New School for Social Research. She is professor of philosophy at Tulane University, where she has taught for many years and holds the Catherine and Henry J. Geisman Chair, and is also the Seisler Professor of Jewish Studies. She has published several books on the work of Plato and Aristotle, as well as articles on various themes, including biblical interpretation. She has also been an editor of publications authored by her late teacher, Seth Benedetti, whose monumental work on ancient philosophy and literature remains a touchstone for many of us. Professor Berger has been a longtime friend of our college. She has lectured at the college in the past. Members of our faculty are students of hers, and some of our alumni have gone on to study with her. Her lecture this evening is entitled Divine Plan and Human Agency, the Biblical Story of Joseph. Please join me in welcoming Rana Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. So many things you said I was going to say. I just feel so much at home coming back here. It's a great pleasure for me, and largely because so many of my best graduate students are products of your education, and some of them are now your tutors, and it just does feel like intellectual home to me. I realized I was last here in April 2001 speaking on Aristotle, and it doesn't seem like that long ago, but the years go by quickly. Thank you, and thank you all for coming when we were competing with burning effigies of gloom. I was going to say something like, here we're trying to understand gloom. There's a handout I think you all have. The quotations aren't so necessarily so significant. I just think it might help to, as you'll see where we are in the following along with the story I want to trace through tonight. So, okay. Divine Plan and Human Agency, the Biblical Story of Joseph. In the beginning, Genesis, like other biblical books, gets its Hebrew title from its opening word, Bereshit, in the beginning. In this case, the title is appropriate in every sense. Genesis is not simply first in order, but foundational. In many and varied ways, it contains the roots of everything that follows, I just remembered one other thing I wanted to say when I made that remark. I sort of wanted to dedicate this to Robert Sachs, this talk, because his commentary on Genesis was with me at my side doing my work. And this comment I'm making that it's so foundational, his book displays that in such a natural way just by following the patterns, recurrent patterns, out of a commentary on Genesis, the whole rest of the Bible emerges. So, when one thinks about it, however, it is a very strange foundation for the Hebrew Bible, more immediately for the Torah or Pentateuch. Shouldn't the five books of Moses, as it is traditionally known, begin with Exodus and God's revelation to Moses on Mount Sinai? Of course, if that momentous event involves an understanding of the cosmic whole, the Bible should open as it does with God's forming of an ordered universe out of a primeval chaos, culminating with the creation of Adam in his own image and likeness. From there, Genesis continues in its first 11 chapters to develop a universal history of mankind. From God's division of the primordial whole Adam into the partial beings, man and woman, to God's division of a unified humanity into the plurality of distinct peoples scattered on the earth. By that point, God has discovered an evil in the thoughts of the human heart, present from birth, and the impossibility of starting over with a new human nature. Another way must be found. That turns out to be a law given to a particular people who are to become a holy nation. This new starting point is ushered in with Abraham, the father of this people. But the father of an extended family will not or cannot be the founder of a community whose identity is to be determined by a divine law. Why then does the biblical account not proceed directly from Abraham to Moses, who will transmit that law? Why instead does the book of Genesis trace a development that unfolds in vivid detail over four generations, from Abraham to his great-grandson, Joseph? I don't want to waste too much time with this, but I can't leave out this beautiful line, I think, from Thomas Mann. The first line of his novel, Joseph and His Brothers, captures that unfolding over four generations. He starts his novel, Tiefste Brunnen der Vergänglichkeit. Deep is the well of the past. I think that captures it. Why is this elaborate family drama required, though, for the foundation of the Hebrew Bible? I make one suggestion to begin with by way of a very rough analogy, familiar, I think, to many of you here at St. John's. In book one of his Politics, Aristotle offers an account of how the city comes to be through a continuous process from the natural starting point of man and woman pairing through the extended family to a more comprehensive community. But his aim is to argue for an essential difference in kind between the family and the city, which explains why the completed nature of the human being depends on the political community. The founder is the greatest benefactor, Aristotle concludes, for apart from law and justice, I quote, man is the most savage of all animals. He has an allusion to Homer's Cyclops, which explains what he has in mind. Incest, cannibalism. Does Aristotle's account, I wonder, have a biblical counterpart? On the one hand, Abraham's lineage can be traced back to Noah and turned to Adam, and forward to the 12 sons of Jacob, who provide the natural roots out of which the 12 tribes of the Hebrew people will emerge. But perhaps the opening book of the Bible, in relation to all that follows, serves to bring to light an essential difference. First, through its universal history, then through its elaborate family drama, Genesis exhibits the features of the human condition that call for a new form of life. The founding of a people molded by a divine law looks like a response to the problems illustrated in the stories of Genesis. Above all, the foundational crimes. One crime in particular proves to be central. Introduced with Cain's killing of his younger brother, Abel, out of envy of the favor God apparently bestowed on him, it concludes with the intended fratricide by Joseph's brothers, out of envy of their father's love for his favorite son. Fratricide, or intended fratricide, is the expression at the extreme of a theme that runs through the whole narrative of Genesis, the rivalry of brothers or sisters. I don't think I ever really reflected before how central that is. A problem that shows up most concretely in the issue of the birthright, which requires the selection on some standard of a first among equals. The story of Joseph and his brothers, with this problem at its core, is the longest as well as the culminating segment of Genesis. As a self-contained whole, its plot fits an Aristotelian model. A sequence of events proceeds by a logic of necessity to a moment of discovery and reversal. In the pivotal recognition scene, when Joseph reveals himself to his shocked and terrified brothers, he assures them that although they did have evil intentions, God has a greater plan, in which they were all instruments for the good. All the evidence the biblical narrative provides, as I hope we'll see, explains events in purely human terms. Yet Joseph presents this as the working out of a divine fate. His reflection at the end of Genesis might seem to confirm an idea introduced at the beginning, when God comes to Abraham with a promise for the future. Abraham questions how he will know its truth. Then he falls into a deep sleep, a dread, even a great darkness, Sazobra. And he hears these words of God, quote, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward they shall come out with great substance." That's Genesis 15. The unifying plot of the history of Israel is announced at the outset. What is absolutely remarkable, and took me many years to notice, is that Abraham never reports this dream to anyone. He's never represented even recalling it himself. He seems to have no memory upon awakening from his deep sleep. We, the readers of the Bible, have been told of a grand design, whether of God or of the biblical authors. But the characters in Genesis act in ignorance of it. No one tries to make events intelligible by appealing to a divine plan. No one until Joseph. And there is something very striking in his case. Of all the main figures in the patriarchal families, Joseph is the only one with whom God has no personal exchange. Is there an essential connection between this withdrawal of God as a partner in dialogue and the notion Joseph expresses of an invisible hand operating behind the backs of human agents? One other feature should be included in this puzzle. The story of Joseph is filled with moments of what could be called dramatic irony. Various individuals utter speeches that mean more than they realize. If we hear, behind the colloquial meaning they intend, the literal meaning of their words, which ascribes to Joseph attributes ordinarily applied only or primarily to God. The character for whom the God of his fathers has withdrawn, who apparently sees his life as the enactment of a divine plan, at the same time takes on himself a godlike status. Why should this figure and his story bring the foundational book of the Bible to a conclusion? I want to go on to his story now, the dreamer. Joseph's destiny does seem to be almost determined before his birth. His father's passionate love for the beautiful Rachel was bound to transfer to her son, long awaited after 10 brothers and a sister have been born to his mother's rival, her older sister Leah, and their two handmaids. His only full brother, Benjamin, yet to be born, will always remind his father of Rachel's death in childbirth. Before Joseph comes on stage, we are introduced to him through what looks like the emblem of his destiny, the famous coat of many colors, which reflects his own splendor, his father's special love, and the grounds for the envy of his brothers. Joseph makes his own initial appearance, age 17, as a dreamer. His later fate turns on becoming an interpreter of dreams. A dream, or more precisely, a pair of dreams, is always the engine that sets this plot in motion. What proves to be the perfect fulfillment of these dreams and interpretations might suggest the idea of divine providence. Yet, the biblical narrative never presents Joseph's dreams as visions sent by God, unlike all his ancestors, nor his interpretations as products of divine inspiration. In the very first words he speaks, Joseph exhibits something essential to his character, reporting his dream to his brothers. "We were binding sheaves in the field when mine stood upright while all of yours bowed down to it." Joseph is apparently altogether innocent of the reaction this was bound to provoke. We wonder if he will ever gain self-knowledge about it. He soon reports another dream, this time to his father as well, whose imagery has expanded from the field to the cosmos. The sun and moon and 11 stars all bow down to him. Jacob's reaction, "Shall I and thy mother and thy brothers bow down to thee to the earth?" sounds like a moral rebuke. But in fact, what if we read it as a genuine question? Indeed, the scene closes with the remark that his father guarded the word, or preserved the word, as if sensing its prophetic truth. Precisely for that reason, it is very difficult to understand what immediately follows when Jacob initiates the crucial episode that will determine the future. And I really don't have an answer to this, and I look forward to any thoughts you might have in our discussion later. It comes immediately now after he's just said that remark to Joseph about the reaction the report of the dream provoked in the brothers. Jacob's words, once again, are more of a genuine question than they might at first seem. "Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send thee unto them." And Joseph responds in the biblical speech of one ready to meet his fate, "Here am I." His father repeats the request that he go to check on his brothers. What is Jacob thinking? He is well aware now of the murderous hatred his other sons harbor for his favorite. And Shechem? The name alone should evoke terror. This is the town where, to Jacob's dismay, two of his sons slaughtered all the male inhabitants in retaliation for one man's relation to their sister, Dinah. And he sends Jacob off there. Joseph. Is Jacob a puppet here of an invisible hand at work? Is he simply acting carelessly? Or does he have an end in mind? Does he imagine that the brothers might resolve their conflict, perhaps in the direction indicated by Joseph's dream? Surely a terrible risk. Jacob will have to live the rest of his life with self-reproach. As the brothers see Joseph approaching, they begin plotting murder. "Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into one of the pits. And we will say, an evil beast hath devoured him." Reuben, the oldest, exhorts the others, "Cast him into the pit, but shed no blood," intending to retrieve the youth later and deliver him to his father. But Reuben always has good intentions that never work out. When Joseph reaches them, the first thing, of course, they do is strip him of the emblematic coat of many colors. Then they throw him into a pit with no water while they sit down to eat, catching sight in the distance of a caravan bearing spices on the way to Egypt. This time, Judah comes up, as he always will, with a persuasive proposal. What profit is there in slaying their brother when they could deliver him to the caravan of merchants to be sold as a slave in Egypt? The brothers, like their father, will experience, at least eventually, the burden of guilt for this intention. But by some moral luck, Joseph is carried off in the caravan before they can carry out their plan. Finding the pit empty, Reuben cries out, "The child is not." An indeterminate lament of non-being that runs through the whole story. Then, as if reenacting a primal substitution of animal for human sacrifice, they kill a goat and dip in its blood the coat of many colors, which they bring back to their father. When Jacob lays eyes on it, he draws his own terrible conclusion. An evil beast hath devoured him. Metaphorically, he speaks the truth, the evil beast of envy. And knowing what he does about his sons, he must on some level be aware of that and of the role he has played. There's so much more to say about that one little line. Maybe we can come back to it later. But while Jacob is pouring his sorrow out, Joseph arrives in Egypt, where he is sold to Potiphar, Pharaoh's captain of the guard. Interpreter of dreams. Joseph's life unrolls in a repeated pattern. Everything that makes him preeminent ends up bringing great misfortune. Yet the very same traits that got him into trouble, intelligence, attractiveness, a sense of superiority, enable him each time to rise again to a higher position. From his initial state of servitude, he is soon entrusted by Potiphar to oversee all affairs of the household. But that reversal is quickly followed by a new fall. Joseph, we are told at an ominous moment, was, quote, of beautiful form and fair to look upon. The very same words said of his mother, Rachel, anticipated all the trouble Jacob would face in his love for her. Beauty is dangerous. Now, Joseph attracts the passion of Potiphar's wife, who commands him in the most direct terms, "Sleep with me." Joseph recoils. He appeals to the trust of his master. I wonder if moral resistance coincides, perhaps, with a calculation about his precarious position. He ends by asking, "How can I do this wickedness and sin against God?" The word there is Elohim. This is not the individual God of his fathers. It is not yet the God who will be the source of the law. Joseph seems to have discovered or invented a divine authority to support the rejection of his master's wife. She, however, is not deterred. On one occasion, Joseph finds himself at her side when none of the men of the home are present. Some commentators wonder why that's the case. She reaches for him by his cloak, and he pulls away. It is left in her hands. Like the bloodied coat of many colors his brothers brought to Jacob, this torn coat provides the tool for her revenge. She brings it to her husband with the charge that the Hebrew servant assaulted her. But we don't hear the husband's response. Could he perhaps have reasons to suspect his wife rather than this servant he trusts so entirely? It is clear in any case who must pay the price. And with no investigation, Joseph is thrown into prison. Of course, soon the young man is again found so competent that the keeper of the prison turns over to him the management of all his affairs, just as the master of the household had done. There are actually some textual grounds to identify these two figures. In any event, they act in exactly the same way, put everything into his management. In prison, the plot unfolds once again from the starting point of dreams. This time, the chief butler and the chief baker, who have been imprisoned by Pharaoh, complain to Joseph that they can find no one to interpret their dreams. And I quote, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" Joseph responds. "Tell it me, I pray you." a seemingly pious and humble rhetorical question leads immediately to an order to report their dreams to him. Joseph identifies himself, at the very least, as the voice for God's disclosure. The butler eagerly offers his story, a vine with three branches brought forth ripe grapes, which he pressed into Pharaoh's cup and gave to him. Now, reading this dream hardly seems to require divine inspiration. In 3 days, Joseph promised, Pharaoh shall lift off up thy head and restore thee unto thy office. When that time comes, he adds, the butler should remember him and bring him out of this pit. He uses the very same word for the prison, like the pit he was thrown into so unjustly in the fields of Canaan. Only after hearing the good news of the first interpretation is the baker ready to interpret his dream. Three baskets of bread stood on his head with goods for Pharaoh on top, but the birds ate it. The baker's hesitancy to speak is supported by the symbols of his dreams, of his dream. In 3 days, Joseph warns, Pharaoh shall lift up thy head, but in this case, lift up thy head from off thee and hang thee on a tree and the birds shall eat thy flesh. 3 days later, Joseph's interpretations are confirmed. The invisible hand of the deity or his own knowledge of soul? The butler, in any case, has forgotten him. His memory will return 2 years later when Pharaoh has a dream or a pair of dreams, which of course you all know. Out of the river came 7 fat and strong cows, followed by 7 lean and sick ones, which swallowed up the fat ones. Then, after awakening and falling asleep again, Pharaoh dreams 7 full and healthy ears of corn grow from a stalk, followed by 7 thin and poor ones, which swallow up the full ones. None of the Egyptian magicians can interpret the symbolism. Seems a little odd. The way I see it is, these dreams are kind of like a play within the play, and it's a vastly oversimplified model for interpretation of the drama in which they occur. If only it were as simple to interpret the whole Joseph story as this dream. Pharaoh's despair about understanding his disturbing visions suddenly reminds the butler of the young Hebrew man in prison, and Pharaoh calls him forth. Joseph shaves himself, tiny little remark there in the passage, but that's the Egyptian custom. He shaves himself and changes his clothes. He initiates his own transformation. Pharaoh greets him with praise for his reputation as an interpreter. It is not in me, Joseph humbly submits. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. His language of pious deference amounts once again to a claim at the very least that God will speak directly through him. This pair of dreams, Joseph begins, are just 2 sets of symbols with 1 meaning. 7 years of plenty lie ahead to be followed by 7 years of famine. The doubling of the dream means God will bring it to pass. But Joseph immediately sets to work on that task. He gives Pharaoh no chance to assess his interpretation, but turns right away to practical advice. A wise and prudent man should be found and set over the land of Egypt. And Joseph just happens to have a policy ready. During the years of plenty, a fifth of the produce of the land should be taken and stored for distribution during the years of famine. Pharaoh immediately sees the spirit of God in this man. There is no one as prudent and wise. He hands over the royal ring, clothes Joseph in Egyptian fine linens, places a golden chain around his neck, has him ride in the 2nd chariot. He gives him an Egyptian name. We can talk about that later if we have time. And an Egyptian wife. When their 2 sons are born, Joseph will bestow names that embody his own mixed tragedy and blessing. By his wordplay, the older, Manasseh, means God hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. The younger, Ephraim, God hath made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Whatever interplay of fate or chance and his own capacities have brought Joseph so far from his origins, now, at 30 years old, he rules all of Egypt. Trial and revelation. As the famine spreads to Canaan, the story of Joseph and his brothers begins to come full circle. Desperate for food for his large family, Jacob looks to Egypt. His grandfather Abraham had gone down to Egypt in a time of famine. His father, Isaac, had intended to. I didn't realize until going back to it again, there's a famine in every generation that sends them back to, down to Egypt. Jacob now sends off all his sons, all that is but Benjamin, the only trace that remains to him of his beloved Rachel. When the brothers arrive and come into the presence of the governor in charge of distribution of food, they bow down to the earth at his feet. Joseph sees the dreams of his youth come to life before his eyes. But while he recognized his brothers, we are told, he made himself strange, unrecognizable to them. This to me is one of the crucial lines in the story, and again, something I hope we can come back to and discuss later. A variant of the same verb, he recognized them but made himself strange to them. A variant of the same verb suggests Joseph's likeness to a god who looks upon his human subjects while concealing himself. But Joseph is about to put his brothers on trial because he does not yet recognize who they are in the deepest sense. And we wonder if he will have to discover something of himself in the process. "You are spies," Joseph charges, "who have come not for food, but to see the nakedness of the land." The brothers protest, but as Joseph persists, they divulge much more than they have been asked for. "We, thy servants, are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not." They speak in the same abstraction of non-being that Reuben used when he found the pit empty, which Jacob will repeat when his sons bring back their report to him. Joseph announces his intention to them explicitly. "By this shall ye be proved or tested." A verb used almost always of God testing the secret thoughts of human beings. I have a list we can talk about later. The test. One of them is to return to Canaan and bring back their youngest brother while the rest will be held in custody. Or, as it turns out, all but one must be sent back if they are all to be tested for their willingness to sacrifice one as they did long ago in the fields of Canaan. The brothers pour out to one another a sense of guilt. The charge of espionage must be divine punishment for their old crime. Of course, they are not entirely wrong. Having communicated all along through an interpreter, they do not realize that Joseph overhears and understands them. But he turns around, hides, and for the first time weeps in secret. As the brothers prepare to depart, Joseph begins orchestrating a sequence of pseudo-miracles. His steward is to fill their vessels with corn, but put back into their sacks the money they had paid. Joseph's enigmatic will is soon implemented perfectly by his intermediary. Total control, as if there's no chance, no obstacles. When one of the brothers discovers the money in his sack, all are filled with fear. A sense of guilt fuses with the mystery of the situation, as if the money that suddenly appears were the payment they never received for the intended sale of their brother so many years ago. "What is this that God hath done to us?" In their tormented state, the brothers speak unwittingly of a man who has adopted the role of a hidden god, putting human beings on trial, and creating through terror remorse for sin, which they may otherwise never have experienced. Sort of dawned on me late in the game that you don't really, I don't think you ever hear of them expressing guilt all the years, all along, until this manipulation they've been subjected to. Returning to their father, the brothers report the demand imposed by the Egyptian lord of the land. They must bring back their youngest brother while another remains behind in custody. As they empty their sacks from the journey, all of them now find the mysterious money inside, and their father along with them. Whatever suspicions Jacob may have harbored about his sons all along, he is now determined not to send his youngest with them. Reuben, with his characteristic sense of responsibility, devoid of good sense, makes a terrible offer. If he fails to bring Benjamin back from Egypt, his father should slay two of his own sons. Jacob, of course, refuses. The famine continues, however. Provisions are soon gone, and Jacob orders his sons to return to Egypt. This time, Judah responds. He reminds his father of what the man in Egypt required. Quote, "You shall not see my face except your brother be with you." The words Judah puts into the voice of Joseph, which he never spoke, have the ring of the speech God will address to Moses on Mount Sinai. "Thou canst not see my face, for men cannot see me and live." Jacob expresses his understandable bitterness. Why did they have to tell the man they had another brother? "The man," they claimed, "asked whether our father was alive and whether we had another brother." We know they offered that information without ever being asked. But Judah, the realist who cannot afford regret, is ready to face the situation at hand. Offering himself as a pledge, he vows to bring Benjamin back, or the blame will be on him forever. Facing the alternative of starvation for all, Jacob is resigned. Hearing the news of his brother's arrival in Egypt, Joseph orders his steward to bring them to his house for a meal. They anticipate a terrible punishment for the money that had appeared so mysteriously in their sacks. But the steward assures them, "Fear not, your God and the God of your father hath given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money." Referring to God's mysterious action, presumably to conceal the orders of his master that he himself carried out, the steward too says more than he realizes. In the presence of the governor, the brothers once again bow down to the earth. Joseph's eyes light upon Benjamin. His heart yearned toward his brother, and he sought where to weep. This is the second time. He has the meal he promised served to the Hebrews in one group, to the Egyptians in another. He himself belongs to neither. It's a beautiful little way of showing that he belongs nowhere. While his brothers enjoy a moment of relief, Joseph arranges one more imitation of a miracle in the trial meant to arouse anxiety and guilt. His steward is to fill their sacks with food while putting their money back, but this time place Joseph's own silver goblet in the sack of his youngest brother. Then, catching up with them on their way out of the city, he is to ask, "Why have ye rewarded evil for good?" When that moment comes, the brothers make a rash offer, confident perhaps that none of them could be involved. "Whoever has the cup in his possession can be killed, the others enslaved." Insisting presumably on Joseph's orders that only the guilty party will be enslaved, the steward increases the temptation to let one take the blame. But when the cup is found in the sack of their youngest brother, the rest rent their clothes and return to despair, in despair to the city. Judah falls on the ground before Joseph. God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Is he thinking of the present situation or their ancient deed? Or have past and present fused into one? As he once proposed the sale of Joseph into slavery, he now offers himself and all his brothers as slaves. Joseph, like a just God, insists on punishment only of the guilty. Drawing closer, Judah speaks in Joseph's ear. He reminds him of their original arrival in Egypt and the question, "Have ye a father or a brother?" which Joseph never asked. "We told you," Judah goes on, that our father's one beloved son was dead, and the loss of the child of his old age would lead to his death. Actually, if you look back, the brothers lamented their plight with one another. They said nothing at the time to Joseph. What you realize is happening is Judah is repeating the very same cover-up his brothers had presented to Jacob. Only they wanted just to protect themselves from their father's blame. Judah now needs to persuade this Egyptian ruler not to carry out his threat to Benjamin. In the end, he pleads with Joseph to take him as a slave in place of his younger brother. Joseph now can no longer restrain himself. Ordering everyone else out, he at last made himself known to his brothers. This verb is used elsewhere only once, of God revealing himself in a vision to prophets other than Moses, Numbers 12:6. So this pattern has been going on all along. Almost all of the verbs and attributes, as I said kind of more loosely, are primarily applied to God. But this one apparently, this making himself known, only is said of God in this crucial passage, God describing how he makes himself known to the prophets. This is what Joseph now does in revealing himself to his brothers. Joseph now weeps uncontrollably the third time. Now the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh hear him. "I am Joseph," he announces. "Doth my father yet live?" His brothers are in a state of shock. He calls them closer. "I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." For them, his identity lies in their guilty deed of long ago. But he goes on to assure them. "And now, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life." That, I think, is the crucial line in the story. Does he merely wish to assuage their burden of guilt? Or is it possible, on the contrary, this is a rather nasty thought that came to me very late, perhaps he's taunting them with the fulfillment of his youthful dreams? Or has he transcended the spirit of resentment altogether in his vision of a greater order? "Return now to my father," Joseph bids his brothers, "and tell him of all my glory in Egypt, like the glory of God Moses will request to be shown on Mount Sinai." Once again, this phrase and this term is almost always applied only to God. The recognition scene ends with Joseph falling on Benjamin's neck, weeping, and Benjamin on his. Then Joseph kisses all his brothers and weeps on them the fourth time. Throughout the narrative, Joseph has been described in terms that should be applicable only or above all to God. His weeping looks like the sign of his humanity, a sign perhaps he himself needed to discover and understand. Reunion in Egypt. Jacob, as we might imagine, cannot absorb the news that Joseph is alive, indeed ruler of Egypt. Only the sight of the wagons sent by Pharaoh laden with goods convinces him. It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. Jacob departs with the whole family and all their possessions. He knows he will not be returning to Canaan, at least not alive. Along the way at Beersheba, the site of the deep well dug by Abraham, redug by Isaac, God appears to Jacob in a vision of the night and assures him not to fear going down into Egypt, the exact opposite of the message he sent to Isaac so many years earlier. Jacob has already made the fateful decision, but God now puts his stamp on it in the last words he will speak in Genesis. "Jacob, Jacob," and he said, "Here am I." God breaks his silence at the end of the story of Joseph, but only to speak once again with his father, Jacob. It's almost the most conspicuous sign of his withdrawal from Joseph. Mounted on a chariot to meet his father when he arrives, Joseph, we are told, appeared before him. Once more, a formula regularly used for God appearing before a human being. Falling upon his father's neck, Joseph weeps a long while, the fifth time. Jacob does not do the same. His only words to Joseph in this exchange repeat the sentiment he expressed before departing from Canaan. "Now let me die, since I have seen thy face, that thou art yet alive." How bittersweet a reunion. Jacob has lived for more than 20 years without his beloved son, perhaps never quite accepting that he is dead. Now he sees him before his eyes in all his glory. Yet he seems to express nothing but a wish to die. Who is this striking young man appearing before him in fine Egyptian attire, arriving in a chariot? How will this Egyptian prince preserve God's covenant with his fathers and carry on the journey to the land promised to them? While the family settles as shepherds in Goshen, the narrative, that's the land that Pharaoh has given to them, the narrative turns to Joseph's role as a political man. As the famine rages, his sale of corn brings into Pharaoh's coffers all the money to be found in Egypt, and Canaan too. When money runs out, the Egyptians sell their herds and their flocks. Finally, they come back with nothing but their bodies and their lands. In the end, as the narrative states so tersely, Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. The policy that has saved so many for starvation is responsible for consolidating all power in the hands of Pharaoh. It contains the seeds of the enslavement of his own people for centuries ahead. Is this just a mechanism for the operation of this divine plan? Or is Joseph acting on his own judgment but lacking some important foresight? Or is his story meant to exhibit the unintended consequences of even the most necessary decisions and actions by a man with the greatest practical intelligence and capacity for leadership? Does Joseph then represent the limits of what can be achieved by independent human agency? In the end, the book of Genesis returns to the family, which has been at its core all along. Jacob, we learn, lived 17 years after arriving in Egypt, the exact number of years Joseph lived in Canaan before being sold into slavery. Kind of frames the whole narrative. When his death is near, Jacob extracts an oath from his son to fulfill his last wish not to be buried in Egypt. He calls for Joseph to bring his two sons and announces, "Ephraim and Manasseh are mine." With this adoption of his two grandsons, who will take the place of his alien son. Jacob prepares for the transformation of his family into the 12 tribes of the nation. He now reenacts at the end of his life the decisive episode early on when he deceived his dim-eyed father, Isaac, into giving the blessing of the firstborn to himself instead of his brother, Esau. But what Isaac did unwittingly, Jacob, though dim-eyed himself, does in full awareness. The text, the biblical narrative emphasizes he's aware, fully aware of what he's doing, and pronounces the blessing of the firstborn on Joseph's younger son. The problem of the birthright, with the tension between nature and convention as the standard, has not been solved, and perhaps never will be. Joseph weeps once more, a sixth time, as his father expires. In the language of the Torah, Jacob is gathered unto his people. But Joseph orders the body embalmed and observes the full Egyptian mourning period before seeking the permission of Pharaoh's ministers to bury his father in Canaan. It's kind of interesting. He's the second-ranking guy in the whole country, and he can't go to Pharaoh. Sort of, maybe we want to talk about that later. Joseph's temporary departure anticipates the challenge Moses will face under a new Pharaoh and the divine miracles that in that case will be needed for Exodus from Egypt. In the final episode, after the burial of Jacob, the brothers fear that Joseph is now free to exact revenge. They send a message conveying their father's desire for forgiveness of their transgression, and Joseph now weeps for the last time, the seventh and last time. His brothers once more fall upon the ground at his feet and declare themselves his slaves, which Joseph rejects. "Fear not, am I in the place of God?" One last time, an expression of the deepest ambiguity. Joseph's rhetorical question, humbly deferring to God as the only authority who can forgive, if taken literally, is a genuine question about his own place in the absence of God. That ambiguity haunts Joseph's concluding speech to his brothers, which reaffirms the idea he expressed when he first revealed himself. "Ye meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive." Has Joseph then come to believe in a grand design, which turns the worst human passions and intentions into an instrument of greater good? What has been called a teleology of evil? Surely a man like Joseph must recognize how much he has accomplished on his own by all his natural gifts. Or is it precisely the assumption of a divine plan at work that has given him the confidence to make something of every situation given to him? It's a kind of hypothesis that leads him to have to grab hold of his own fate. I wonder if that's the way to read this in the end. Joseph's vision, in any event, is restricted to the perspective of his lifetime. It does not extend to the long view once disclosed to Abraham. In the dynamic of the biblical trajectory, God will have to intervene once again in human life to bring about the liberation of his people from enslavement in Egypt through a series of miracles that echo the miracles of creation and the cataclysmic flood. That intervention begins with God calling out to Moses from a burning bush in the same form he last addressed to Jacob, evoking the same response. "Moses, Moses," and he said, "Here am I." Echoing those last words, "Jacob, Jacob, here am I." Joseph lives in the silence between those moments. He stands in a borderline between the patriarchs who experience a personal relationship with God, and Moses, who will be the legislator and founder of a people, a nation. Moses, it is true, will be engaged in an intimate and extended interaction with God. Yet the purpose of that association is to prepare for the withdrawal of God in order to leave the divine law in his place. Is God's silence with Joseph a stage in that development? As his own death approaches, Joseph demands an oath from his family, as his father did from him. Ye shall carry my bones up from here. Do these, his last words, express recognition of belonging to his family after all? In the account of the Exodus from Egypt, we do hear that Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. There are many, many interesting comments and stories about that. They're carrying the ark in one spot and the coffin of Joseph's bones next to it. But the final lines of Genesis sound to my ear a much darker note. Quote, so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. End of the story. Whether by divine plan or the biblical author's plot, God will return to Moses 4 centuries later to begin the project of transmitting the divine law. But the book of Genesis concludes with an implied counterfactual, suggesting the contingency of all human things. If God had not returned, his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would have come to an end with Joseph embalmed in a coffin in Egypt.